These guys have earnings coming up next week.
Then you've got the labor. I mean, the labor here is tremendous. I mean,
15.3% is the number, which is alarming.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And here we are in the Allstate Skyline studio on this Tuesday afternoon. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. John Najarian will be along in just a couple of minutes with any luck at all. He's just wrapping up his halftime report on CNBC, and we'll talk to him about what's going on Wall Street. Eric Rung is in the newsroom. We'll check in with him in just a second. Later in the program, also, Scott Calvert will be here, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, to talk about, among other things, the Philadelphia is one city, but I think there have been a few states as well that have prohibited cashless stores. And we'll talk to him about that. Caitlin Owens writes for Axios, and she'll be around to talk about drug prices and what we pay out of pocket for prescription drugs this year. Actually, it's comparable to around the world, but when you take into effect the amount that insurance pays, we actually are paying a lot more for prescription drugs than most countries around the world. So that's coming up on the Biz Lunch right now. Eric Rung's in the newsroom. Eric, in one of the stories, you know, we talk a lot about college finance and all of that. The story about the scholarships and the efforts of these parents to get their kids into school, paying bribes and things like that, I would imagine is sending a shockwave to college president offices around the country.
Yeah, I mean, we've really just scratched the surface on this. I mean, we're talking at least 50 people have been charged so far in what prosecutors are calling a college admission scam. And we're talking millions and millions of dollars paid to people to try and get their children into some of the best schools in the country.
And you know what? The names that are getting the attention are Felicity Huffman, and then Laughlin. Lori Laughlin, the actresses. The big story here is the test facilitators, right? I mean,
there's
somewhat corrupt inside the SAT organization that's making these changes.
Right. There were some students that paid these facilitators to change answers to get better scores on the SAT. Some coached the children on how to take the test to make sure that it doesn't raise any red flags. So again, more and more information about this just coming out, and it's really kind of mind-blowing of how enormous this really is.
Eric Rung in the newsroom. We'll hear more from you at 12:30. Thanks, Eric. I appreciate it.
You got it.
On the phone line now, John Najarian from CNBC joins us on most Tuesday afternoons. John, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Great to be with you. Thank you very much, Stephen.
Right, so the last quote I'm seeing is that Boeing stock is down 7.4%, $29.73 a share. Tell me about the situation Boeing is facing today.
Well, other than, of course, the terrible loss of life, the loss of confidence is crippling. And there are a lot of folks that are seeking protection from put options and things like that. And that's one of the reasons that Boeing is trading down, because a lot of the hedging, it's not just people leaving the stock, it's people hedging their exposure to the downside in the stock. Most institutional investors want to hold on to it, but as they look for that protection, they put further downward pressure on the stock, and that's certainly playing out right now.
Today, you know, we had Britain, France, Germany, Ireland, those are the ones I can name quickly off the top of my head, governments essentially grounding or prohibiting use of this particular airline that was involved in two now catastrophic crashes in the past few months. But we haven't seen it so much from the airlines, and I'm not sure what that's about. I mean, obviously they have two different roles. The airlines don't want to crash their jets either, but they also would seem to know more about the training and the aircraft than would the governments overseeing the jets.
Very much so. Obviously, certain jurisdictions probably have a higher degree of compliance with exactly what's in that Boeing flight manual, because this is a different aircraft. I know you guys and your listeners have heard this probably, but the engines are moved slightly forward to get better fuel efficiency, because they found that in their computer modeling, that's what happens. It also has a system on board that can cause the nose of the plane to dip, and the plane is supposed to compensate for that. Now, the pilots that have been in trouble with the plane have been fighting with that system, And when you fight with software, you need to either turn it off or there can be a real problem. And so far, there have been two catastrophic problems. And that is beyond the loss of life. Again, that is a real problem right. for Boeing because, you know, they need to put through a software fix, a kill switch or whatever that might disable that particular bit of software that has caused these nose downs, which can end up in, you know, the plane basically heading down and the pilot fighting with it.
All right, let's go across the sea then. I guess we were anyway. But Theresa May is once again, I don't know, is she fighting for her political life? There's a vote scheduled in the House of Commons today on her latest Brexit deal that she secured. We've seen the Northern Ireland Party back away from it. I think her own Attorney General is saying it might not offer the protections they need. It looks like the Brexit vote yet again could be in peril in the House.
Yeah, and if it is, then there are several outcomes, of course. If the vote does not pass tonight, and I would say it's an outside chance that it does, not a high percentage chance. So if it doesn't pass, then they'll have another vote tomorrow. And that will be to do basically a vote on whether or not they would accept a hard Brexit and or what the extension of the time that they'd look for to come up with another solution would be. I'm sure Europe is running out of patience with the UK government, and I'm sure that a lot of people within the UK are running out of patience with their governing bodies. So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. Again, it's a minority chance, but there is a chance that she got just enough to let the DUP in the north of Ireland support her on the Brexit, and if that happens, that would be very
I think the DUP, they came out against it today, didn't they, already, the DUP?
You have me at the advantage there. I did not hear that. They were expected, I thought, to support that, but maybe it didn't go far enough. Obviously, a hard Brexit nobody wants.
Right. I'll try to get an answer to that, John. You're more up to it than I am. But, okay, there's that then. What do you think the chances are that Brexit just goes away completely? I mean, is there any chance that it will be abandoned?
Yes, that is one of the options on the table, I'm sure. But that would depend, of course, on the European Union accepting them after they've pulled that Article 50 that basically details exactly how they're going to exit. And Britain didn't like how the exit was going, and that's why they've had all these debates since then. But that is one of the options, and I'd say it's got to be at least a 20% or 25% chance that that scenario plays out.
The latest headline I'm seeing is that, and this was from 3 hours ago, DUP and ERG signal opposition to the deal. So it may well be that they're just signaling and having. Well, no, it says another one says it's a no. DUP statement means Brexit deal less likely to pass. So yeah, she's got an uphill climb coming up tonight.
Yep, it'll be interesting, and it's not too far off. I mean, we're right now approaching whatever 6:15 over right. in London in the evening, and they're going to be pushing for this just a little bit.
I have a friend who's a conservative member of the House over there, and we were emailing a couple weeks ago, right up until I asked him to come on the show. Then he stopped answering me, so I'm not sure what that's about. what are you looking at today?
Let's see. We saw some strong activity in a drug stock, Pfizer, that we liked. They've got some strong results as of late, and it's a $41 stock. We were buying that one today because of big institutional buying.
John Najarian, great to talk to you. Let's do it again next Tuesday.
Thank you, sir. You too, Stephen.
It's 12:23. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, in the studio now is Brian Amoah. We talk about Chicago Crypto Capital a lot. He's a managing partner there. He's been on before. Brian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And you know, I told you when you come in here, you have to talk slowly because this I have a hard time getting my arms around. I think a lot of people do, right? And that's kind of what you're about, is explaining this to people.
Yes, that's why our company is really trying to take a very complicated technology and make it simple for people.
Is it complicated because it's complicated, but also because it's wholly new?
Yes, that's correct.
It's not like it's a different form of transportation. It's just a completely wholly new sort of way to think of things.
That's correct.
And so there's the story about Facebook. Facebook, of course, it has privacy problems. Their stock has tumbled because of privacy concerns, but they make money out of selling ads. So they're trying to figure out a different way to make money, and maybe it will be to sell things through their WhatsApp app with encrypted cryptocurrency.
Correct.
Right? Explain for me how that would work and why that's good for them.
So it's good for Facebook because Facebook has a large network of users that they really can't monetize other than advertising to them. But if you have 3 billion people in your community or whatever Facebook's number is, then you have that many people that could transact with each other and have many other interactions that they could profit off of.
And so this would mean if I wanted to not maybe buy a used car from you, but buy a pair of jeans from the Gap, things like that, I could do it using a Facebook-created cryptocurrency?
Correct. It'd be a stable coin, a coin that would be a unit of currency. And companies like that, because if I'm selling this pair of jeans to India or to Ireland or the United States, I don't have to worry about 100 plus currencies that they have on their platforms and, rates of currency rates and things like that. You have one unit of measurement.
So when we talk about this stuff, we use the term Bitcoin for cryptocurrency, but Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency, right? One of many?
Correct.
And so will other cryptocurrencies of Facebook, a big player, gets involved, will they be hurt by this?
I think the way these companies typically use the technology is they're going to look to form their own coins, whether it be Starbucks looking to track their seeds or Amazon potentially looking to get in other ways. These older coins are decentralized, and these companies tend to exist on control, and they would like to control their own networks. So they're just going to operate in different ecosystems.
And so, look, was I reading that Chase is coming up with a cryptocurrency?
Yes, Chase is doing another thing. They're very popular. They're called stable coins, and it's just the idea of having the common unit of measurement across your whole network.
Okay, so then how does all of this fit with what you do at Chicago Crypto Capital? I mean, does this hurt your business? Does it help it? Is it irrelevant to your business?
No, it's very encouraging for us. We're industry players, and we work with as institutionals. We like regulation. We like the ecosystem, and we are the company that's investing in the ecosystem. So things like this is very encouraging.
So it's not really a zero sum game.
No, not at all.
So the more players, the better for you.
Yeah, exactly. Think of it like the internet. You know, just the more internet companies that were coming, if an accounting software came out, didn't really hurt the gaming industry. In fact, there's several type of games and several types of categories. So they all build together.
So when I read the commercial for you, and we didn't plan on talking about this so much, but you talk about how you are sort of at the ground level or the beginning level of some companies. Explain for me what you do for clients. I mean, if I were to walk into you and say, I want a consultation like we read about in the commercials, what does that mean?
So we typically look at a client and see what kind of their goals are as far as getting into cryptos, and we'll form a strategy. We'll help them get invested in the companies that have a lot of potential that we see that's going to be part of the future and that can give returns to our clients.
With a lot of the headlines about Bitcoin are bad.
Oh,
right?
Of course.
Does that bug you? Does that bother you? Or is that an opportunity?
You know, as our company, we always distinguish ourselves from the common retail investor who for sure was hurt. The guy who was buying in December of 27 at the highs. Yes, of course, they did very poorly. But for us, you know, we have a research team. We're kind of ahead of some of these things. You know, last year was a very good year of growth for us as a company. You know, we got a new office. We hired, revenues were high, record highs, employees hired. So, you know, we pride ourselves on being educated, and that, you know, our clients come to us for that reason.
Brian Amoah is managing partner at Chicago Crypto Capital. I love when you come by. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
I'd love to come back again.
Thanks very much, Eric Rung. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank, here on 720 WGN. Thanks very much for tuning in on this Tuesday afternoon. It looks as if, well, the weather's not too bad. It might be breaking. We could get in the 60s later this week. All right, in the basement of our building here over the Chicago River, there's a Mexican restaurant. It's great. Great prices, great food, but they only take cash. They don't take credit cards, and I rarely have cash in my wallet anymore. I just don't, and I would shop there a lot more if I did or if they took a credit card. We're talking about the reverse, actually, though, now in Philadelphia, in Massachusetts, and elsewhere, where municipalities and even some states are passing legislation that would ban the use of or the operation of cashless stores. Argo T here in Chicago accepts no cash, only credit cards, Apple Pay, things like that if you want to pay. On a phone line now is Scott Calvert, who's been writing about that for the Wall Street Journal. Oh, Scott, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, so tell me, are you based in Philadelphia?
I'm actually based in Baltimore.
In Baltimore, okay. So tell me where we are in Philadelphia. This law has been passed and signed. It's not taken effect yet, correct?
That's right. It takes effect in July. And so starting in July, the law says that if you're a retail establishment in the city of Philadelphia, you have to accept cash. There are a few exceptions. So if you are a wholesale operation like BJ's or Costco, if you're a parking garage, you don't have to accept cash. Rental car companies, hotels can still require that you give them a credit card for incidentals. But by and large, you've got to accept cash if somebody's got it in their wallet.
If you're going out to pick up lunch, you've got to have cash in your wallet to you've got to accept cash from the customer if he or she wants to use cash to pay for it.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And so New Jersey has passed something similar. I don't know if you know if the governor's going to sign it, but there's already a statewide ban in Massachusetts.
That's right. The statewide ban in Massachusetts actually has been in the books for quite a while, but the New Jersey bill that you mentioned is more recent. The legislature there has passed it, sitting on the governor's desk. He hasn't said one way or another whether he will sign or veto that. In New York City, there is a bill working its way through the city council that is similar to the one that the Philadelphia City Council has passed and that the mayor has signed. So there are a few places where this seems to be percolating through.
So when I read about these stories, I'm thinking, well, they're just it's contrary to the progress. I mean, people aren't using cash anymore, and they're only inhibiting businesses when they mandate that they do allow cash. That's one side of it, but when you read about the fact, there are some pretty good arguments for mandating that people do take cash payments as well, aren't there? And when it comes to the poor in the country.
Right. Well, that's the principal argument in favor of this kind of legislation. I mean, sure, most people have a credit card or debit card in their wallet, maybe Apple Pay, like you mentioned earlier. But the fact is there are something like 8 million households around the country that are considered unbanked, which means they don't have a checking or savings account. And so for a lot of those folks, it's cash is going to be what they've got. You can get a prepaid debit card, but there are fees associated with that.
But the businesses who won't take their cash, they're going to be hurt by that. So why wouldn't these governments let the free market decide, let the store make its own decision?
Well, that's certainly the argument that you'll hear from groups like the National Retail Federation. Their view is let a business experiment, and one of two things will happen. Either they'll find that they lose business and they'll go back to accepting cash, or they'll find that it works for them and that should be their prerogative. There is no federal law requiring you to take cash. So that's one view. The proponents of this kind of legislation basically say it shouldn't be left to the market and that it's just sort of a basic fairness, that it's essentially discriminatory, even if that's not the intent, to say that people who only have cash, can't buy their sandwich at your deli.
The Philadelphia mayor's office says 26% of the city residents there live below the poverty line, and many don't have a bank, and so that's part of that. You could put cash on a debit card or a cash card, but then you're paying a fee for that as well, so that isn't so fair either. All right, Scott, look in your crystal ball. What is as we move to become a cashless society, are there going to be more and more laws requiring that stores continue to take cash?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, there may well be, but it's worth pointing out that even in Philadelphia, the mayor, he signed it and he acknowledged the fact that, geez, we have a lot of people living below the poverty line. But he also said that, he's worried about inhibiting retail innovation. He doesn't want to do that. And there was an official with the city's commerce department who said, look, modernization is going to happen with or without Philadelphia, and we want to be part of it. That was a quote from her. Uh-huh. And so there's a sense that maybe this kind of law can be a bridge or a temporary measure until people can figure out a way for the unbanked and people who are lower income to participate in a cashless society, because there are a lot of people who think, that's the direction we're going, and it's going to happen.
We didn't really mention the fact, though, that it's cheaper for stores to take only cash. They don't like necessarily to take credit cards, but it's more efficient for them. It's quicker. It also cuts down on employee theft if there's only plastic being exchanged.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. because, you know, you think typically a lot, you go into a lot of stores and they'll actually sometimes have a little card saying, you know, please pay with cash because otherwise we have to pay X percent as a transaction fee. But for the ones that are going cashless, yes, I mean, it's basically safety and efficiency. Safety means that they are less likely to be a target of a robbery. They don't have to have employees, you know, taking the cash to the bank to deposit it. Less of a threat of people, you know, employees putting their hand in the till. And then on the efficiency side, it's just faster, particularly if you do a brisk lunch business. If you don't have to count out cash, you can process more orders in a short period of time. That's sort of the efficiency argument.
God, I love my Apple Pay. Scott Calvert is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He's writing about this and more there. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day.
Calling all students and soon-to-be graduates.
This one goes out to you, because you probably need a job soon, otherwise it's back to mom and dad's house, and I think everyone would agree you'd rather not be in their basement. The 1871 Internship Fair is happening tomorrow, Wednesday the 13th, from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. I don't think there's a better way to get exposed to hundreds of tech startups than being around 1871 all day this summer. So if you're looking for a way to get into the tech scene, this might be the one. But if you're looking for a way to get into the marijuana industry, the legal marijuana industry, that is, then Chicago could be the hotbed for it. Marijuana legalization is still high up on Governor Pritzker's priority list, and another Chicago company just got bought out for $850 million. Phoenix-based Harvest Health and Recreation bought out Verano Holdings for $850 million, and they're planning to expand the nationwide footprint that the company already has. And that's before many other states have even legalized the drug, too, so they're gearing up for the market that will surely be here soon. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
It's 12:53. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. All right, on the phone line now is Caitlin Owens, a reporter at Axios. She covers healthcare, Congress, and other policy areas for them. Axios, love Axios, one of my favorite websites. Caitlin, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I want to talk to you about a couple of stories you've been writing about. One is, we were just talking in the earlier segment about how municipalities are now banning cashless stores in some towns because they're worried about the poor and they won't be able to buy their sandwich for lunch and things like that. Another area where government might be getting involved, and well, has been forever, really, is in cigarette smoking. And you write recently about a federal trend, perhaps, toward a ban on smoking for anyone under 21. Now, here in Illinois, I think the smoking age is 18, but in Cook County and Chicago, it's 21, so it varies by municipality. There's talk in Washington about a national restriction of no one under 21, right? What are the chances of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll see how this plays out. But it's an interesting coalition that's pushing to raise the smoking age here in D.C. It's really tied to this youth vaping, use of e-cigarettes trend, where, I mean, you know, it's really, it's becoming a very big deal. It already is a big deal up here. FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb has really pushed a regulatory agenda to crack down on youth who are using these e-cigarettes. So I think that's really shifted the conversation a lot. So what we're seeing here is that, you know, last Congress, Democrats had a bill that would have raised the smoking age. And now, I mean, I've been talking to some Republicans who are increasingly either pushing for the idea or are increasingly open to the idea, or at least, you know, hearing a lot of buzz about it.
Well, Gottlieb,
and then what's also,
I was going to say, Gottlieb, you know, is certainly a champion of that, and he made a big deal out of busting stores for selling electronic cigarettes to underage people. Walgreens was prominent in that last week, but Gottlieb is leaving. I mean, is some of the momentum going to go with him?
You know, I don't think we're sure yet. That's a big question, is who his successor is going to be and how they will implement his agenda. Today, a new acting director of the FDA was named, and we're still sorting out where he stands on things. I think that's part of this, though, is that industry, I mean, there are industry groups, tobacco product industry groups, are also supporting raising the age. So I think, you know, some people are saying, and I'm hearing that part of the calculation here may be, you know, without there not, especially with him out, that raising the age might be a way to kind of convince the administration to stop the regulatory side of things.
And that's why Juul, who sells vape and cigarettes, is actually in favor of raising the age. Okay, we got a minute and a half left. I want to talk to you about the story you wrote about what we spend on prescription drugs in the U.S. and how it compares. And, I mean, the brief headline is, when it looks at out-of-pocket, we're pretty much in the running with other developed countries. But when it comes to the gross cost, we're way out of line. Explain that for me.
Yeah, that was actually surprising to me. And so what that basically means is that we pay our prescription drugs are a lot more expensive, but we have pretty good insurance coverage of them. Now, the problem, so that means we're, you know, these drugs are really contributing to our high premiums here in the U.S., but then about out-of-pocket, people are paying on average is the key here, on average, about the same amount as people in other countries. Now, since our drugs are more expensive, if you have to pay the list price of a drug out-of-pocket, say if you're uninsured or have a high deductible, then your out-of-pocket cost can be astronomical. But I think it really just kind of drives home that people who are paying those sky-high out-of-pocket costs are really the minority here.
That's a good point. But the other point is, but overall, we're paying, I mean, the prescription drugs, I don't know if we're being prescribed more prescription drugs here in the U.S. than other countries, but when it comes to our insurance and all, we're paying, I mean, the average is $1,016. In this graph I'm looking at, the next closest one is Switzerland, where it's $794, more than, well, $300 less.
That we're paying much more than other countries for our drugs.
Which means it's in the system, and we're paying for our insurance premiums or copays or things like that one way or another. I got to run, but check that out at axios.com, AXIOS.com. Caitlin Owens, great to talk to you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's